On this week's podcast, we're joined by Molly Stevens from Uber, who shares how a modern digital-first company approaches improving the user's experience. This week's podcast is sponsored by Full Story and Balsamic. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show is Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. There, Paul. You keep talking about moving into your house on every show. Well, you just get more and more kind of like downhearted every time I speak to you.
Oh, it's bloody exhausting, this moving house business. It'd be all right if it was just moving house, but of course we're renovating our house, moving back into it, and it's not done. And it is, you know what they say about, you know, these kinds of projects, that they are money pits, and they really, really, really are.
We've just found this new architectural treasure underneath your floorboards, and we'll have to bring in, I don't know, a museum to dig it up. It'll cost you £1 million.
Mm-hmm. yeah. Or in our case, we've just found that most of your building, most of your house is structurally unsound, and we need to rip it down and underpin it. And yeah. Oh, and the whole of the front of the house has to come off as well. And so it goes on. So yes, it's joy. But I tell you what, there is definite. It so annoys me that I do this, but I can't help but go through experiences like this and go, well, there's lessons to be learnt here from a user experience perspective. It's like, oh, for crying out loud, Paul, get a grip. But just about, you know, communication and, you know, it made me think a lot about how we work with clients and custom, you know, our customers, our clients, and how scary it almost feels to them. Because they have the equivalent experience that I'm having with a builder, where I don't know anything about it. I don't understand what's going on. And especially as well, because the way we've done it, you know, it's not a fixed price project. You know, it's agile, you know, so you don't actually know what you're getting for your money. And all of that kind of stuff. And you can understand why clients freak out, because you do feel totally out of control of it. And of course, to us as web designers, it all feels so natural. And, you know, we've just been down to the house talking to the guy who's doing it all. And he's so calm and, well, you know, yes, it's all under control and it's all going to be fine. While we're freaking the hell out. And I'm thinking that's what it feels like to be a client on a web design project.
Yeah, it's about understanding the processes, isn't it?
Yeah.
And even no matter how much we rattle on about it at the beginning, we expect people to just understand what we do
and remember all of that, and to feel, you know, to be confident in that. A lot of it's about confidence, isn't it? You've got to be confident in your supplier and believe that they're going to do what they say they do and do it when they say it. And it only takes one little thing, and you can lose that confidence, and it kind of knocks the relationship. And I tell you, the other big thing that's really come across to me is how important regular and clear communication is. You know, we found it quite hard to get hold of the lead building guy, the manager who's managing all this. And immediately it undermines your whole attitude towards the process, because, you know, of course, if your supplier isn't communicating with you, you feel all the more out of control, and that makes you more panicky and all of the rest of it, doesn't it? So there are really good lessons in it, if it wasn't so horribly painful.
the problem is, from our side, is, I don't know, it's nobody likes to be the bearer of bad news.
Yeah.
So often, I guess, suppliers in any field will think, right, we'll just knuckle down for an extra week because we lost those few days, and we'll just get it back in. Mm-hmm. But they don't communicate it because they don't want to sort of make it look like they're, you know, not promising what they said they would or anything like that. So, it's a real toughie, isn't it? That kind of continually it's easy to keep up to date if everything's going well and everything's on track. It's just if things are going wrong, or you get, obviously with something like house renovation, you will find surprises that you just don't know are there. Web design, that's less likely, but you do come across hurdles that you hadn't planned for. If somebody's ill or something like that, I never want to sort of say to a client, well, we've lost a bit of time because somebody was ill, even though it's a perfectly legitimate thing. You just sort of feel it's a bit neggy and a bit kind of maybe not quite what you want to be saying to them. But yeah, you're right. You need to just constantly communicate whether it's good or bad news.
And of course, the thing is that you're all the time, from the client's perspective, you're all the time juggling this thing, whether it be a house build or a website or whatever, it doesn't really matter, with lots of other different criteria that have all got to kind of fit in with it. So we, you know, in my case it's like removals people, you know, and when we give up our rent on our house, you know, those kinds of things. But you know, in a web design it might be tying it up with a marketing campaign or a new CMS or whatever else. So if someone isn't giving you, you know, a long runway and heads up of potential problems, then it can be too late by the time you find out about them. So you know, we could have rented this place for another month and it would have been kind of fine. We could have dealt with that. But we'd handed in the notice by that point, and so you're committed to it. And, you know, so it's also, I think this is the biggest project I've ever undertaken where I've been on the client side of it. Yeah. And I know it's not a web design project, but it certainly, as someone that's worked my entire career on the agency side, it's made me a lot more sympathetic towards clients.
Yeah. Great, isn't it? Will you be in your new chair at your new desk when we do this show next week?
I will be somewhere other than here. That's all I can commit to. I might be coming to you live from a garbage bin somewhere.
There's always the Headscape office.
Yes. No, I should be in. Whether we've got any internet access, who knows? At the moment, we don't even have a phone socket. So, you know, that's a bit of an issue. But my desk is arriving. That's arriving. Ooh. So I've got nowhere to put it. But, you know, I've got a desk. Paul coming live from the garden somewhere. Yeah.
The pub garden.
Yeah.
On his new table.
Exactly. The table would be great. It'd just be everything else that'd be shit. Anyway, I've kind of done my thought for the day, which is more of a rant for the day. But what about yours? What have you got for us?
What I've got today, and this is something I will admit I've kind of spoken a bit about before, but it's this idea, taking a slightly different viewpoint on it, of recognising that clients are different, and that if you've worked in a particular sector, I don't know, the charity sector, there is potentially a chance that we all might just think that, well, their requirements are going to be the same as the last one, and they're going to be the same as the last one, that kind of thing. So what I'm going to talk about is kind of recognizing, being awake to differences, uniqueness, if you like, and how to deal with that, if you like. This came about really because we work with, I've mentioned before, we work with US law firms. One of the firms we work with, still are working with, but we did a kind of major project with them last year, are basically, they're kind of one of America's premier litigation firms. All they do is courtroom, you know, the kind of telly type stuff. And they very high profile people hire them to defend them and all this kind of stuff. And we were aware of this reputation before we started working with them. So we imagined this kind of ultra-aggressive, adversarial company culture would be the kind of culture that would accompany a reputation like that. But what we found was really quite different. So when we interviewed a number of their attorneys, we were trying to understand the firm's objectives for its site, who its users are, character and personality, and all the usual things that you're trying to do when you're doing stakeholder interviews. But we started notice trends in what people were telling us, and significantly, they all said that they wanted the site to reflect how different the firm was. That kind of maybe taken literally was that they wanted the site to look manifestly different to other law firms. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that before. You've heard that before.
Yeah, Paul. Yeah. many people say it and then they don't want it when it comes to it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, we're, you know, we're a quirky bunch of guys here, kind of thing. And then you give them a quirky design and they go, oh, no, 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 our clients won't like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And what they actually want is a kind of better version of their competitor's site. So it was, with the case of the law firm, it was a case of going back to them and quite simply, but being bothered to do this, but basically saying, is that really what you mean? I guess the key question was, do people hire you because of your differentness, because of your uniqueness? Mm. And the short answer was yes. So then that gave us the platform to, or gave us the kind of the green light to ensure that their design was different to your average law firm.
Mm.
So yeah, that's kind of it really today on my thought, but just sort of pay attention to the fact that people might be telling you something different to what you think you're hearing.
Yeah, and that happens so often. You know, communication between people is massively unreliable. That's why I love things like prototyping and mood boards and wireframes, because it's something tangible, you know, that you can actually see, because people are really bad. Well, I don't know whether people are really bad at expressing or we're really bad at hearing, or probably a combination of both, really. Yeah,
that, and it does just underline the fact that all of these kind of maybe sometimes feel a bit silly exercises that we do in workshops are actually really useful. Like, you know, I've known people to roll their eyes before internally about we're going to do some mood boarding with the client. So
yeah,
we're going to get divided up into teams. But that exercise with this particular client that I'm talking about was massively helpful. And we actually took some of the elements from one of the mood boards that they did, made it all the way into the final design. So often it's just those kind of exercises are just to get people thinking about the whole process and, you know, understanding our processes. But in that case, it really did inform the design. So well worth it.
And the trouble is as well, is that we can use exactly the same words, but kind of have different meanings for them. You know, what one person considers edgy or radical, another person wouldn't, you know, and so actually it's a bit like, isn't it, with pain. You know, it must be horrible for doctors to have to go, you know, how much pain are you in? Well, my sense of pain is totally different to someone else's sense of pain, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, that's why they use the 1 to 10 thing. Mm. You're still thinking, well, I don't know, I better be brave and say 4.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like that. But actually, just one more final point on that. Another thing we did, or we do this with most clients now, is exactly that idea of what does an open design mean, as opposed to a kind of formal design. So what we've started doing is saying, this is what we mean by these. This is a kind of a mood board or a bunch of images, kind of different styles that mean formal or informal. And this, and which way do you lean?
Yeah.
So we don't have to do that kind of guessing what people, you know, what people think different words mean. Anyway, I'll shut up now.
No, it's good. And also sometimes I think to do the opposite is good. You know, okay, so you say you want a casual design. Well, what doesn't that mean? You know, what wouldn't be included in that? Because sometimes thinking about the opposites, that helps, or it does me anyway. Anyway, let's talk about our first sponsor, which is the wonderful Balsamic, my favouritest friends in the world. I'm so enjoying working with them. Actually, talking about, you know, different kind of character types, I'm writing two things at the moment. I'm putting this course together with Balsamic people, and I'm doing another piece of work with another client that I won't talk about. And could not be a more different experience between those two. You're basically delivering very similar thing, but, you know, just totally different approaches and attitudes, and it's fascinating. I have to say, I'm more inclined to the Balsamic laid-back approach. Yeah, they're really lovely team. Anyway, so if you don't know, Balsamic is an easy-to-use wireframing tool that's got an incredibly low barrier to entry. Anybody can pick it up and basically use it straight away. So pretty much every person we've spoken to on this show has said that they've used Balsamic at some occasion. But it's also great for non-professionals too. So people that aren't designers, you know, it's aimed at actually at marketers, managers, you know, those kinds of people. You know, as designers, we've got our fancy tools that we like for whatever reason. But you know, there are other people that need to express their ideas as well. And don't be afraid of non-designers producing wireframes and getting stuck into that process, because it helps them, helps you to understand what their expectations are. Going back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, them just telling you is not really enough. You know, you need to be able to see it. It'll also help you head off any problems early, because if they start doing ridiculous things, you want to know up front. And also, let's face it, non-designers can have good ideas too. You know, it's not an exclusive thing, which is something that you taught me, Marcus, years back. And I think I was a bit kind of the arrogant designer mindset. But, you know, if even you have occasionally had a good idea. So that kind of proves the point, doesn't it?
Well, I was just saying in the intro, some of the ideas that the client came up with in the initial meeting ended up in the design.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a really good collaboration tool, basically, and you should give it a go. You can give it a go by going to balsamic.cloud, where you get a 30-day free trial, so you can have a good play around with it. If you do decide to sign up for it, then I recommend adding in the code BOAGWORLD alongside your billing information, because that will give you an extra 3 months for free. Which obviously is very worth it on top of the 30-day free trial as well. So yeah, check that out. Okay, so let's then dive into our interview for today. So we've done some fascinating interviews already this season. It's been really interesting, and we've talked to people from Virgin Atlantic, we've talked to people from University of Dundee, Cisco, IBM. But what all of those companies share in common is that they are all pre-digital companies. They've all been around for a long, long length of time, right? So they've got a lot of legacy and that kind of stuff. But what about a company that doesn't have all of that legacy, that's come around more recently? And obviously, as you will have heard from the introduction, we have Molly Stevens from Uber on the show. And she's going to talk to us a little bit about how a post-digital company works, you know, how they're set up, how they approach user experience, and whether they take a different approach to things. So Molly, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your role at Uber? What is it that you do there?
Yeah, I'm the Director of User Experience Research. That's a global role, so it looks across all of our products and services and around the world in the 65 countries we're located in.
Uber's now in 65 countries, is it? That's amazing.
Yeah, it's quite the scope and complexity that we have to deal with. It's very interesting.
So what does your job kind of consist of on a daily basis?
So in my current role, a lot of what we're looking at, I would say, roughly falls into working with the product and engineering teams to ensure we're covering the top priorities, working with my managers to make sure things are flowing well on their teams, looking around the globe to make sure that we have the right coverage in the right locations. Mm-hmm. Quite a bit of hiring and recruitment because we are growing the team quite a bit. And looking at how to, you know, maintain and grow our team vision and mission and what we work on, you know, how we work as a UX research team.
Mm. So what does the kind of role of the team consist of? I mean, it's kind of in the name, isn't it? It's doing user research, but I'm kind of quite interested in how that process works. You know, are you doing research that is almost commissioned by particular parts of the organization, or have you just got an ongoing program of research? How's it structured?
So we have a mix of research. So first, in terms of methods, so my team has a pretty wide range of skills and experiences. We work across highly qualitative research, like field research and ethnographies and anthropology-focused work, all the way to quantitative survey analysis, in some cases logs analysis, and kind of everything in between. We work on a kind of a semi-embedded model or hybrid studio model, can come up with any kind of name for it. But basically, our researchers are focusing on a particular specialty or area where we need to have deep expertise and user experience research. And they work closely with those product and engineering and design stakeholders to figure out what needs to be researched. In some cases, that might be something that the one of their stakeholders has asked for, so something specific that they're trying to find out either for a near-term product or for possibly figuring out what goes on the roadmap. Or it might be something that we've identified, so research that is happening because we have seen certain types of things in the field, or we're identifying certain kinds of findings in surveys that indicate to us there's an unexplored research question, and we'll work with the teams to prioritize that and make sure that work happens. So it's a definite mix of both.
So does your team kind of sit together in the sense that are they, you know, or are the members of your team kind of embedded in other groups across the organization? Does that make sense?
So we've recently started sitting together. We were more embedded until recently, and that's why I say hybrid studio model. We're sitting together now to see what kinds of efficiencies that brings us and what kind of benefits we have. I'm a big believer that seating patterns and reporting structures and all those kinds of things are tools that you can use to kind of make certain things more important within your organization and make changes. And if it's not making the change you want, then you can, then you change it back, you know?
Yeah.
Lots of UX teams have gone from being centralized to decentralized to back to centralized. and so we recently all moved to sitting together or, you know, in clusters as best we can across our different buildings and locations. And we'll see what kinds of efficiencies that brings us.
Yeah, it's because there are pros and cons to both, aren't there? You know, there's obviously efficiency gains to be by being together, not repeating, you know, yourself, etc. But then on the other hand, there are benefits to being deeply embedded within teams in order to refocus them on the research and what they know about the users. So yeah, it's a tricky one to get right, isn't it?
It is, and I think it varies per team too, right? So if you have a product team that's you know, you have great trust with and they really believe the work you're doing and very connected to it, kind of doesn't matter where you're sitting. But how you get there, maybe you do need to be more present and able to answer those questions. So it's definitely varies a lot per team.
How do you deal with the international aspect of it? Do you have researchers around the globe, or are you trotting off every now and again? I mean, I know at the moment you're in Amsterdam. So is it that you're traveling around the world a lot, or do you have localized expertise?
We do both. So I think it's important for us to have localized expertise, folks who are, you know, from the region or who know the region really well, who can help us do a better job of addressing regional issues. And our folks also travel for projects, depending on what's happening. We've also recently started a program called the Global Scalable Research Program, where we have locally embedded teams that can run at a regular cadence, that can run studies to help folks back at headquarters who might need to test something but also don't want to be traveling a ton. And maybe it's something more discreet and kind of smaller. It's not a full field study. And so we've been doing that. It started running in January, and we're getting great results from that.
Oh, that sounds interesting, because I mean, it is, that's the danger, isn't it, with user research, that yes, you want to do the more in-depth detailed stuff, but the danger is that it becomes perceived in the organization as onerous. So, you know, having that lighter weight model as well, I imagine helps very much.
Definitely. definitely. It's one of the reasons why we needed it, because one, we're global. Two, we need quick turnarounds on smaller, lightweight projects. Mm. And three, we do need to also then build up our knowledge of those regions so we can do things like create design principles or common user needs principles from these. And if we don't have regular feedback from those regions, it's quite hard.
So, I mean, there is one other kind of aspect to this, the scope of your role that I'm quite interested in is, you know, so far we've talked about the user, and I imagine in most people's mind, when they think of the user, they think of the person that's getting into the vehicle and being driven wherever. Do you do research on the driver side of things as well, or are you exclusively on the customer side?
No, we definitely do research on the driver side. In fact, when I joined Uber about 2 years ago, I was managing the driver research team.
Ah, okay. Right. I see. So in some ways, you almost see the drivers as much as users as the customer. Is that a fair comment?
Absolutely. Mm. Our drivers really are Uber in the wild, right? Mm. When you call an Uber, it is that, you know, those people who show up at your door. And so it's really important for us to understand what they need. You know, what are they looking for? What are their pain points? We recently launched a redesign of the driver app that was really focused on us working closely with drivers to understand a lot of their needs. And then, you know, build something that met those needs from what we understand.
So, I mean, that's quite interesting, because you then get into kind of broader culture within the organization, because obviously, you know, you can easily think of, if you're superficial, you can easily think of Uber as an app. You know, it's the app is your point of your touch point, but actually it's not. It's, you know, it's a part of the experience, and the experience includes the drivers and the rest of it. So I'm quite interested in, you know, obviously Uber is a newer company compared to some of the others that I've been talking to on this season. So it's been built with the user in mind from the very beginning, but I'm quite interested in what that means beyond just the user interface, you know, in terms of your drivers, in terms of company culture, in terms of how decisions are made within the organization. You know, what do you think it is that's different about Uber's user perspective than maybe a more traditional company?
What I find that's really unique about Uber in terms of thinking about the user experience, it's very different than other products I've worked on before, is the kind of immediacy within the world that what we change and what we work on has. So the kind of immediate impact, right? So if we improve the navigation app, you know, and we're doing X million trips a day in the US, you know, that is incredible, right? It has a very immediate impact. It can help get people home faster, avoid traffic. You know, drivers might get an extra tip if they do an extra good job. There's this like very immediate impact on the day-to-day experience of the folks who are both driving and riding. And so I find that's one of the most unique pieces about working at Uber, and it's one of the ones that I find the most compelling too.
And that being able to draw a very direct comparison between, you know, changes that you make and the impact of those changes is so helpful. I mean, I work with a lot of organizations, you know, for example, I do a lot in the higher education sector, where drawing, you know, a decision like that, you know, what university do I go to is a prolonged decision. Then the experience is a prolonged decision that lasts over, you know, years, and has a lifetime impact. While, you know, and so it's quite hard to therefore measure, you know, the impact of things that you're doing, because they might have an impact 2, 3, 4 years down the line. Well, I'm imagining in your situation, it's, you know, it's very instant. You make a change, you're getting data back straight away, basically.
Yes, yes. And that's really, really compelling. It also means, though, that we need to be really careful about not just focusing on short-term impacts, but what the long-term effects are of the work that we do. It can be kind of seductive to see that a number is going up, you know, and be like, oh, things are magical, everything's great. And then, you know, 6 months down the road, you see unintended effects and you have to be careful about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you see that all the time. You know, I know you guys have struggled a little bit with reputation because of that. And you're far from alone. There are many, many companies that have, you know, fixated on certain metrics, and that is then influenced, you know, the experience in unintended ways. And that actually brings me nicely on to the next question, which is, how does Uber balance those kind of user experience issues? They want to provide a great experience both to their drivers and to their own customers with the kind of demands that go alongside running a company like Uber, which is, you know, in terms of kind of financial growth, and there is this expectation that Uber grows rapidly. Do you find that there's sometimes conflict between those two things? And how do you address that? How do you keep people focused on user needs?
I find that Uber pretty consistently is very focused on user needs.
Oh, good.
Across the board, which is great. I think the complexity that we run into is the fact that Uber primarily is a marketplace. Mm. So things that drivers want aren't necessarily things that riders want, or vice versa. So we work very hard to try and understand the core needs that are consistent and can help balance out the experience across the whole marketplace, and then design and work on experiences around those things, right? It's, you know, marketplaces are a very unique beast in terms of how they, you know, how they interact and the different levers you can pull and push on the different sides. I saw this a lot at Google when I worked on in the ads area, where basically we had Google AdWords on one side and AdSense and publishing on the other. You know, it's a very similar in some ways to what I've been experiencing at Uber.
That does raise an interesting question, mine, because you just described Uber as a marketplace, which I totally get. But do you think that's how most people see it? Is there a disconnect between how maybe Uber sees itself as being a marketplace and your experience of talking to users who perceive Uber like a taxi company? You know, are you trying to fight a kind of existing preconception of what they're getting?
Well, I think that most companies have a variety of ways that they are seen by the people who use them, right? So an example would be, you know, Google, right? Some people see them primarily as search, some as a phone company, you know, all the different aspects. So there's some of that that we can't necessarily change or affect very much. I think the most important thing that we've been working on is making sure that the people who do use our tools understand our good intentions and, you know, that we're trying to improve the marketplace the best that we can for everyone who's involved. Oh. A good example of that would be this fall back in August last year, we launched the 180 Days of Change campaign for drivers, and the focus was on 6 months of different features and changes and launches to really talk to drivers about how we were trying to improve things for the better for them. Mm. And a lot of that was based on user experience research that my team had done that showed we were falling short in some areas and that we needed to be making improvements. And I mean, I think the other thing is too, is that Uber is very different things to different drivers around the world, for example. Whereas a driver in India has a very different level of need and urgency on the platform than, say, a casual driver in Florida. And so we have to take all of those things into account.
It is. It's really fascinating for me to see the kind of history of someone, you know, a company like Uber that, you know, obviously have come in and they've radically disrupted a market that was open for change because there were obvious huge holes in the user experience that needed fixing. So, you know, it's a beautiful case study in that regard. You know, a really crappy experience for most people. Somebody came in, offered a good experience and completely, disrupted the market. But now we're kind of moving into a phase where, you know, Uber matures, you've got two things happening. You've got Uber beginning to experience some of the problems around scale, especially, you know, from the globalization point of view. And then at the end time, you know, you've got your old competitors effectively cloning and copying what Uber are doing in an attempt to run up, you know, to catch up. So it's very interesting time, I'm imagining, to be involved with Uber.
It is. I'm consistently just amazed and excited and blown away by the kinds of research questions we get to dive into and that we get to have answers to and help our teams build great products. So it's a very fun and interesting time. And I can definitely say I've never been bored in the 2 years.
So tell me a little bit about how you structure the management of user experience within Uber. I mean, so you've got your team, which is a user research team. But I'm imagining there are other teams that do different aspects of user experience. You know, maybe you've got those people obviously that are working on the user interface. There are people working maybe on the driver app. There are, you know, so how's it kind of organized?
So the design and research functions roll up to a central contact. That's our new VP of design, Michael Goff. Mm-hmm. So I report to him, and the vast majority of the researchers at Uber report up to me. So we have a centralized UX research and design team.
Sure. Okay. So what about, and then what about other aspects? You've got head of design. Do you have anybody exclusively responsible for customer experience, or is that responsibility kind of distributed across the entire company?
Yeah, we have some other groups at Uber that focus on, say, the support experience, or the we have these green light hubs where in all the cities where drivers can go to get problems solved and get coffee and meet each other. They have, you know, folks working on that kind of almost service design experience. So there are definitely other folks at Uber worrying about other parts of the experience. And we typically would collaborate closely with them to make sure that we're creating as holistic of an experience as possible.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That kind of makes sense. What about in terms of things like metrics? You know, what metrics are you measuring around experience? Are there kind of general kind of company level metrics that you are tracking, or is it all individual project level?
So we definitely, for different projects, will create success metrics that are relevant to the particular project we're trying to, build or launch or get out into the world. And then there's company level metrics also. You know, Uber is known for the amount of data we have and how that data influences how we, you know, build and design our products. And we really look closely at that to make sure that we're measuring not just all the things we can, but the things that really matter.
So can you give me some examples of what metrics you keep an eye on from a user experience point of view? Are you using, I don't know, something, you know, as old school as the Net Promoter Score, or are you looking, travel time, or what are you looking at?
Well, it's funny you bring up Net Promoter Score. I can get on one of my favorite hobby horses, which is why I feel that the Net Promoter Score is often a poor metric for four different kinds of experiences. It has its uses, but so when I joined Uber, we were using that promoter score to understand the driver's point of view. And it really was not the right metric to use for a variety of reasons. One is that many drivers, so if you phrase the question, you know, how likely would you be, to recommend a friend or family to drive for Uber? In many of the places where we have drivers, cars are actually very expensive. And you might answer that question not because you don't like driving for Uber, but because you literally don't know anyone who has a car.
Yeah.
Right. And you can go on and on. I have like three or four examples why this particular net promoter score question was bad for drivers.
So what did you replace it with then?
We've replaced it with a basic satisfaction question. So like, how satisfied are you with driving for Uber? We've found that it's much more indicative of driver behavior. It gives us a much better measure for whether or not they're getting the experience they want on the platform. You know, we can set net promoter score aside in that case.
So I'm guessing from the customer's side, a lot of it is about the reviews and the ratings that they give to drivers. Is that the main metric you're looking at there, or are there other ones that you're interested in?
It's definitely important, and I can't get into any more specifics beyond that. But, I would say that it varies a lot per item. So, you know, one of the projects that we were heavily involved in, the driver profiles project, so if you have a driver coming and you see that you can tap on their picture and see a bunch of metrics and details about that driver. So how long they've been driving for, how many trips they have, whether or not they have compliments and things like that. That would have a very different set of metrics than something like a new payment method, right?
Yeah, of course.
It varies pretty wildly project to project.
So I'm quite interested with the kind of projects that you work on. Are there any that you feel you can tell us about, and what you did and what you felt you achieved from doing that?
So we recently did a redesign of the driver app, and what was very important to us was to try and make the experience of earning on the platform as seamless as possible, right? If a driver is coming on and they would like to find rides and, work for several hours, how do we make that a very positive experience and to do it globally? Because we're, not going to be launching something in just one market. Typically, usually it's multiple markets. So we worked closely with a number of folks outside of the U.S. and did we started by collecting all the research we knew about the driver app and that experience and what the edges of that. So like what they were doing, what they were doing at home, when are they choosing to go online? What's that whole experience? And we used that to come up with some initial designs. And then we did a huge amount of global testing regularly over the course of about 9 months to ensure what we were designing wasn't going to break the experience in any of our major markets. And then at the very end, and there's a great video if you want to see a lot of the folks on my team, there's a great video of the beta program that we participated in and had a large influence on, where we launched to a certain number of drivers in all of our major markets and really partnered with them. We called it the Building Together program, where we had them be beta testers for the app we had them do diaries. We were partners with them. We basically found some of them pen pals on WhatsApp. We did a huge amount of data collection to really really get a sense for what was happening on the ground with these beta users, so we could make sure that when we started rolling it out, it would be as positive as of an experience as possible.
That's so interesting to hear. That kind of shows you what happens when you start working at that kind of scale, that, you know, not only had you've got all of those different global markets to consider, also you've got that the impact of getting it wrong is enormous, isn't it? You know, you really have to be sure. And so the idea of rolling it out, the number of times I am just amazed where people go, okay, we're done, and they just roll it out to everybody all in one go. And these are big organizations that really should know better. And you just think that is such a gamble, you know? Yeah. Brilliant. No,
it was a gamble that we couldn't afford to take.
No.
And also, you know, it's really, really important for our drivers to understand that, you know, we're partnering with them on this, that, you know, the intention of this is really to make their experience better. And, you know, just the super positive engagement that we had from them throughout the course of the beta demonstrated that that was, you know, just really a great experience for them.
And that's another big, you know, what you just said there is another huge part of it, isn't it? It's not just what you get back, what you learn from the audience that you're working with, you know, like drivers. It's also what it says to them about your attitude. You know, by engaging with them and including them, you're saying, I care, you know, we care about you. We care about what you're trying to achieve. We don't want to make things difficult for you. And that is as valuable as actually what you learn from them in many ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a partnership.
Yeah. Okay, one last question, and then I'll let you get on with your busy day. I just wanted to ask you, just to finish up on a little bit about cross collaboration, right? Now we've kind of touched on this a little bit throughout the chat that we've had, but I'm interested in any kind of ways that you've managed to work with other people across the organization, because a big part of user research in my experience isn't even so much the research itself, it's making sure that that research then becomes embedded within the thinking and behavior of the organization. So how do you go about making sure what you learn gets taken into account?
Yeah, there's a number of ways that we do that. So one of the main things is working hard up front to try and collaborate and coordinate with the other insights functions at Uber, like marketing and data science, some of our operations teams in the field, to make sure that we're all on the same page about the research that's getting done, that we know what the intention of, you know, gathering that data is going to be, and whether or not they already have some information or you know, background on it that would help us do a better job, or maybe we don't need to do it at all. Maybe they already know the question that the product team is asking. So we do a lot of upfront cooperation and collaboration. And then during the research and, you know, involving as many stakeholders or interested parties as possible, which is a, you know, a good consistent practice across user experience in general. And then at the end, you know, once you have your insights and your, you know, data together, your observations and knowledge gathered, I find in general that, it varies a lot in terms of how teams, you know, how teams might want to digest or you know, share knowledge. I've used everything from, you know, reports and kind of standard readouts to collaborative sessions where you have everyone on the team watch a video and do a group debrief. So they really start to internalize the findings from some of the individual users, to taking a report, a document report, and putting it in a spreadsheet. what is the communication method that will, you know, really connect with your particular audience or individual, and trying out different ways of telling that story. You know, what's the medium, you know, that you're trying to get it across, and figure that out.
I mean, essentially you're using, you know, good user experience and user research techniques on your own stakeholders to communicate with them in the best possible way, aren't you, really?
So, absolutely. Yeah. use that tool set as much as we can.
Okay. Absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for being so open and sharing insights into to how you approach user research and user experience within the organization. It's really interesting to kind of get a little sneak peek behind the doors. So thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So there you go. What do you think of that one, Marcus?
I love the fact that they've got a kind of whole team dedicated to just user research. It's just this big company mentality that I'm not used to. As I've already said in the past on this show, I have no desire to go back to that big company sphere, but it's great that they have, you know, so much kind of granularity in the roles that they have. But the thing that struck me most about it, and it's just this is just as a user of Uber, is that I consider their user base to be me and other people like me. I just don't even consider that they have drivers who are a completely different audience. And basically what the impression I got was they are the important audience to the company. Isn't that weird? It's kind of like because they're in between, you know, Uber the company, drivers, and then us, the end customer. So it's kind of like the relationship that they have with the drivers seem to be like, you know, if they really had to choose, that would be their most important audience. I may be wrong in that, but that's the impression I got.
I think it is. I think it's true to a large extent because they're the public face of the company. So they're the ones that have the biggest impact on, to be honest, on their revenue, I'm guessing, you know. And so, yeah, they've been certainly more recently, they've had a bumpy road on occasions with drivers. And so, you know, I think they're working particularly hard in that area now, which is really good to see. Going back to what you were saying, mine, about the having user research teams and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, that I found very interesting because if you compare them as a post-digital company to a pre-digital company of approximately the same size, doing the same kind of stuff, you know, those companies wouldn't have a user research team. It wouldn't even occur. They'd have a marketing department. But do you know what I mean? So things like user research, user experience, these are much bigger operations within, you know, post-digital companies, which I find a really interesting thing. And you could argue, oh, well, that's because Uber's primary contact with its clients is through a user interface. But, you know, these pre-digital companies don't even have big customer experience teams, right? Do you see, there's no one that owns the customer experience in that same way. And I think that's an interesting shift that grabbed my
attention. It's just the sheer kind of volume of people dedicated to it. I think that probably large, you know, I'm guessing, but let's say Unilever, for example.
Yeah.
They will have people that do user research for them, but I suspect quite a lot of them will be third party agencies. But it won't have the same focus that a company like Uber has, I'm guessing.
Well, actually, it's very interesting. You mentioned Unilever because I was doing some mentorship with someone from Unilever, and that you're exactly right. You know, they will occasionally hire an agency to do that kind of work. Yes, they do have people with some experience of doing that kind of stuff, but they're very fragmented across the organization, very decentralized, with very little control over the direction that they're going. So it's a very different mindset. The power sits in a different place. So it's interesting to observe. Anyway, so that's Molly from Uber. Let's talk quickly about Full Story, who is our other sponsor for the season. Full Story is a session recorder, as you probably will have gathered by now, and it's a really useful tool in your arsenal when it comes to doing user research and doing user experience stuff, as we've just been hearing. If you haven't got a session recorder running on your site, get one, right? They, you know, whether it's Full Story or not, make sure you have one running because analytics don't tell you the full story. You know, analytics
no pun intended.
I know, right? Analytics will help you identify a problem, but won't really reveal the solution. And of course, you can use usability testing, and you should use usability testing to help you understand what's causing the problem, and, you know, investigate some possible solutions. But as soon as you put someone in a usability test session, they're not going to behave naturally, you know, and they're going to want to please you, and they're going to want to, they're going to behave differently simply because they're being observed. And you might think, oh, I don't know whether that's true, but I mean, it's just to show you how profound an impact, you know, being observed can have on behavior. They did a study where they had an honesty jar in an office, right? So whenever people had tea or coffee, they had to put money in the honesty jar. And, what they started doing is they, 1 week they would put up a photograph of a pair of eyes, right, just above the jar. And then the other week they'd just put a bunch of flowers, something very neutral, picture of a bunch of flowers. And when the eyes were there, it caused something like a 44% jump in the amount of money being put in the jar. Just the thought of being observed, right, changed people's behavior. So can you imagine, you know, and that's not to say usability testing is not worthwhile. It absolutely is. But it should be a part of the mix alongside analytics and alongside session recorders. They give you, you know, some of the deeper insights you get from usability testing, but also the numbers and scale of analytics. So now, just be clear, session recorders don't replace analytics. They don't replace usability testing, but they are something else that should be a part of your testing approach and arsenal. And to be honest, if you're going to look at session recorders, Full Story is simply the best out there. There are other services available, as they would say on the BBC. But, you know, I'm not the BBC. Get Full Story. I absolutely love it. You can sign up and get a 3 month for free of their pro account. If you want to carry on using it at that point, then great. You enter your credit card details at the end of your 3 months, so they're not tricking you into it or anything like that. But if you don't, if you feel it's not for you or you can't justify the money, then you can obviously walk away, or you can continue to use it for free for up to 1,000 sessions per month, which is, you know, on smaller sites, absolutely adequate. So to sign up, you can go to fullstory.com/BOAG, BOAG. Okay, so that's pretty much it for this week's show. Marcus, what do you have for us joke wise
I have an appropriate joke this week.
Ooh,
yeah. Two guys are in a bar. First one says, do you know a good GDPR consultant?
Oh, for crying out loud.
Second one says, yeah. And the first guy says, oh, great, can you give me his email? Second guy says, nope.
I shouldn't laugh at that. I'm so fed up with GDPR.
I think they're an art form. Some of them are just like, oh, but some of them are brilliantly worded. I wish I'd saved them, you know, just to try and get your attention. Oh, hello, we're over here.
Yeah.
It's just, they're wonderful. But quite a lot of them are like, we've changed our policy, end of.
Yeah.
You know, it's how people are interpreting it is completely different. It's like you must sign up here and then sign in again there and then change your preferences and blah, blah, blah. Because there are a few things that I do want to stay signed up for.
Yeah,
but others have just gone, we've changed our policies, thought we ought to let you know.
Yeah,
thanks.
And you know, if you start having a discussion about what you should or shouldn't do as part of GDPR online, it turns into a firestorm of you know, contradicting ideas. I don't know whether you've been sucked into it, but I've just avoided talking about it. You know, I've just basically not taken a position on it because I just do not know. You know, every time I read about it, I get a slightly different interpretation of how it should be done.
Yep.
So there you go. But what the best one I saw was on Twitter, where somebody says, you know, described it as, it's like, you know, an ex-girlfriend begging you to have them back. You know, these obscure people you've got no memory of ever interacting with suddenly contact you and beg you, yeah, please fill in this form, please.
Yeah. Funny, isn't it? Anyway, yes.
It is.
So there you go, appropriate joke of the week.
Indeed. Okay, so that's pretty much it for this week's show. Hope you found it useful. We got a fun one for you next week. We've got Matt Curry coming back on the show. It's been a very long time since we've had him. And he's going to talk about probably the most unusual user experience challenge you will ever come across. If you don't know who Matt Curry is, I'm going to just leave it hanging at that. But I promise you it will be both entertaining and very, very insightful. And I think you'll learn a lot about
our psychological behavior for this.
yeah, absolutely. I describe what Matt does as extreme user experience. You know, it's like it really is a little bit out there. So join us for that next week. But until then, thanks for listening. Oh,